Our next case is case number 54713, First Commerce Bank versus Stevenson. Ms. Wendt for the appellant, Mr. Cannon for the respondent. These parties are appearing before the Northern Panel of the Supreme Court of Nevada, and I guess you're lucky you didn't have to fly to Carson for this, fly to Reno and then drive to Carson. We hope to, this was actually Justice Gibbons' idea. We've been on the Northern Panel together for quite a time, and Justice Pickering joins us now, and we just felt it was fair to your clients and to yourselves that you'd be able to walk over here and then go back to work while we consider these cases. So it's our pleasure to be able to do this for you and your clients.
We appreciate the court's indulgence making itself available here.
Thank you. Mr. Wendt, you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Did you want to save any time on this?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time.
Our pleasure. Mr. Wendt, on behalf of the appellate.
This case is about contractual rights and normal contract interpretation principles, not about the expansive application of an equitable doctrine like estoppel to unfairly alter the written agreements between the parties. On about February 1st, 2006, the bank entered into a lease agreement with Camino Al Norte for the lease of what has become the bank's principal office. Before the bank could open for business, the space had to be designed and built to suit the bank's needs. As part of the negotiations to obtain the bank as a tenant of the subject building, the bank's landlord agreed to provide a tenant improvement allowance. This tenant improvement allowance is stated explicitly and in no uncertain terms in the lease and in the associated documents. So construction of the property commenced, and the bank periodically received and paid invoices from its contractors hired to complete the necessary tenant improvements. In May of 2007, prior to the completion of the construction of the tenant improvements, the bank was asked to sign an estoppel certificate in connection with the pending sale of the subject property. Consistent with its obligations in the lease, the bank executed and returned the estoppel certificate, and the sale of the property eventually closed. Subsequently, the construction of tenant improvements completed at the property.
What genuine issue of material fact defeated application of the estoppel certificate as to your client?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's a good question, and there's one very big issue of material fact, and that is, what is the knowledge of the new purchasers? There's no doctrine of estoppel that will save a party from its ignorance of the true facts. So in order for the doctrine of estoppel to apply, the party that's seeking to assert it has to be ignorant of the true state of the facts. Here, without the chance to do discovery on that particular issue, the court erred in ruling in favor of the defendants here. The issue of material fact is, what did the new landlords know about the status of the unpaid tenant improvement allowance? That knowledge, if they went into the deal with that knowledge, would not allow them to rely on an ambiguous estoppel certificate that doesn't expressly address the tenant improvement allowance.
Okay.
Did you put in a Rule 56F affidavit?
Yes, Your Honor. The Rule 56F request in the motion and the supporting affidavit was included in the motion, Your Honor. And what the request in the motion and supporting affidavit was designed to do is to point out to the court that there are these issues which we need discovery on before we can know if the doctrine of estoppel can even be applied. This court's rulings in its previous cases has indicated how you can apply the doctrine of estoppel. And we know from this court's rulings in the MGM case that the doctrine of estoppel cannot be applied unless the party seeking to estop it is seeking to assert it is ignorant of the true state of the facts.
Well, but this is a written certificate, and it's an estoppel certificate that is a little different from an equitable doctrine of estoppel, correct?
It's different in the sense that we do have written representations of fact, but the whole principle of estoppel is the same. So what we have to do, and where the district court erred, is look to the express terms of the estoppel certificate. And none of the express terms of the estoppel certificate explicitly address this unpaid tenant improvement allowance. So then we default to, what does the lease say, and what do the parties know and intend? And here, with the discovery still ongoing and open, there was still an opportunity to obtain discovery as to what the new landlord's actual knowledge was, affirmative knowledge of the unpaid tenant improvement was at the time that it closed its purchase. For all we know, they could have accommodated this purchase. There might be money sitting in an escrow account somewhere, Your Honor, specifically for this unpaid tenant improvement allowance. Discovery was still open. Chance to conduct that discovery was denied by the district court's ruling.
Justice Gibbons, do you have a question for Mr. White?
Not right now.
Okay. What you do?
So the law regarding estoppel certificates, Your Honors, is the same as any normal contract interpretation. That's What do the actual statements of fact therein state? And here, there's only three possible provisions of the estoppel certificate that concern the unpaid tenant improvement allowance. The first is Section 6 of the estoppel certificate states that all conditions of said lease to be performed by a landlord and necessary to the enforceability of said lease have been satisfied. District Court unfairly ignored the operative clause of that section, which is necessary to the enforceability of said lease. What's clear in the lease is that enforceability of lease does not hinge on the payment of the tenant improvement allowance. And so, in Judge Bell's order, the District Court found that the unpaid tenant improvement allowance constitutes a condition of the lease to be performed by the landlord, but she ignored that operative phrase, necessary to the enforceability. How do we know what the tenant's remedies are in the event of a default by a landlord? We look to the lease. Section 22.2 clearly states, notwithstanding any provision of this lease to the contrary, tenants shall have no right to terminate this lease in an event of a default by a landlord here under. Forcibility doesn't hinge on the payment of that tenant improvement allowance.
How do you get around the fact, though, that at the time your client signed the estoppel certificate, they had already spent the money on the tenant improvement allowance and had a claim back, although unasserted, against the landlord? You say that the lease prohibits any offset, but I read that to clause differently. Maybe I'm missing it, but paragraph 2 on the tenant improvements says there's no payment or rent reduction from the landlord for any part of the tenant improvement allowance is not utilized by the tenant. To me, the negative pregnant in that is to the extent they used the tenant allowance, it was an offset against rent, in which case you're right in under paragraph 9 of the estoppel certificate. Am I missing something?
Yes, Your Honor, and there's nothing in that lease. Number one, the first issue that you suggested in your question is there was a time when the bank had incurred all its reimbursable expenses. Am I correct
right.
in understanding
yes.
the first part of the question? And so,
of its tenant allowance.
Yes. So there was a time prior to the execution of this estoppel certificate where the bank had incurred all of its reimbursable limit. Your Honor, there's nothing in the lease that sets out an expiration date for the payment of this tenant improvement allowance. That was not negotiated.
But you're arguing in your brief that they would not have been allowed to offset what they spent on the tenant improvement allowance, and therefore paragraph 9 of the estoppel certificate could not cover this. That's your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And so what is
where do you get that they could not have offset the tenant allowance that they spent against the rent to the extent of the $217,000 that they were allowed under the work letter?
Where we get that is from the text of the lease itself, which
what
states
paragraph?
That rent commences. Let me direct the court's attention to the record. Commencement date, Your Honor. The commencement date of the lease is in one of the addendums cited in the brief.
Maybe when you come back up, you could answer that question.
I could reserve that for rebuttal.
Yes, that would be great.
Page 145 of the record, the appellate's appendix. The commencement date of the lease is set forth therein. There's nothing in there that states that the bank could alter or change its obligation to pay monthly rent. And part of it depends on what the nature is of an offset, Your Honor. I would like to reserve a portion of that for the rebuttal to clarify the point as to where the text of that is in the lease. However, I would like to clarify as well the doctrine of estoppel and offset. What we know about an offset is it's mutual debts incurred by both parties subject to extinguishment. It's another equitable principle. I suspect we'd have a different kind of problem if the bank decided to withhold its rent based on the unpaid tenant improvement allowance. In fact, discovery would show, that's why Rule 56F request should have been granted, discovery would show that part of the increased market rent that the bank was paying was to compensate this landlord for the fronting of the tenant improvement expenses. And so to say that the bank could just withhold rent for various months until it was reimbursed the amount of its tenant improvement allowance is something completely different than what was negotiated by the parties. And discovery would show, in the event that we had a chance to complete it, discovery would have shown that that was a term negotiated by the parties. Double market rent in exchange for reimbursed tenant improvement allowance.
Okay, Mr. Wendt, maybe this is a good point in talking about the discovery and completion of it, is what should the standard be under Rule 56F that that a moving party would have to show the court as a basis to exercise your discretion to allow to grant additional time? And number two, why did you comply with that standard? And number three, well, just want you to answer those two questions.
Yes, Your Honor, the thing, Rule 56F, the moving party has to show that no matter what a defendant or a plaintiff, the non-moving party, could ever find a discovery will change the law in this case, or the application of the law, the facts of the case. And here we have one big important fact that would have completely changed this disposition. That is, what was the actual knowledge of the new landlord? So, yes, so in order to prevail in opposing a Rule 56F request, the moving party would have to show that no matter what got found out in the remainder of discovery, it wouldn't change the application of the law of the case. And here, that can't be true, because if evidence were to come out that they had affirmative knowledge of the status of that unpaid tenant improvement allowance, structured their deal, closed it accordingly, that can't save them from an ambiguous, or they can't rely on an ambiguous estoppel certificate, which would, in essence, result in a windfall to them if they knew about that account debit. Secondly,
on that point, the affidavit of the bank president says the bank disputes the defendant's contention that they, quote, had no knowledge of the alleged non-repayment of the tenant improvement allowance. Is that what you're relying on as your 56F affidavit in support of further discovery?
Yes, in connection with the actual text of the motion, which clearly includes a request that this one specific fact, Your Honor, if we had a chance to conduct discovery on this one specific fact, it could be enough to result in a denial of their motion. And that's what we need to find out. Discovery was still ongoing. That can't be in dispute, because the scheduling order so provides. So there's still a chance to conduct that discovery, which would completely alter equitable estoppel in no way could apply if they had affirmative knowledge.
And did you outline for the court what discovery you felt you needed to produce evidence on that critical point?
In fact, in oral argument, and it could be done as simply in request for admission, Your Honor. It could be done in just simple written discovery. So to the extent that there's an extended amount of time that need to be conducted, it's just simply one request for admission. Admit that you had affirmative knowledge of the unpaid tenant improvement allowance, and no matter how they answer the question.
Because they put in an affidavit that said they didn't.
Yes,
they said they're.
They don't precisely say that they didn't have understanding of the unpaid. And if it's true that they did conduct proper due diligence and they did rely on a record which reflected that tenant improvement allowance was paid, now we got a misrepresentation. They were fraudulently induced into a deal, not based on any misrepresentation the bank made, but based on a misrepresentation of some other parties. They may have a claim against their seller for reimbursement of whatever expenses they've incurred as a result of getting into a deal based on a clear misstatement of fact. But that's not a misrepresentation the bank made. This is a clear lease obligation, Your Honor. There's nothing different about it. The estoppel certificate is ambiguous, doesn't expressly address it, and there's no reason for that to change the express written obligation. And that's why the district court got the holding of Yee completely wrong. District court ruled in the holding of Yee that estoppel certificates can bar subsequent tenant claims. There's nothing special, extraordinary, or magic about an estoppel certificate that lets it be a shield for a landlord to prevent it from complying with all future obligations, Your Honor. That's not what an estoppel certificate is. You read the provisions of it, they're presumed to be true. You know, the district court might have more correctly summarized the holding of Yee if it would have said something in this nature. It would have said, just briefly, Your Honor, a landlord is entitled to rely on a tenant's executed estoppel certificate, and its specific provisions must be read carefully to give it effect, as the statements therein are presumed to be true. The district court got that completely wrong, and what the district court wrote in its order about what the holding of Yee was is not found anywhere in that text, in that decision. All we're talking about is normal document interpretation principles. Read the estoppel certificate. What does it say? How does it apply to the lease? And what does it say about the tenant's obligation? There's nothing in there that's different, Your Honor. With that, I conclude. Thank you.
I'll give you a full 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Cannon, on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address first, I think, the questions that both Justice Gibbons and Justice Pickering brought up. Namely, what are the requirements under 56F in order to allow a district court judge to grant the motion? This court has entered two orders, or two cases came down, and both of those cases set forth the specific requirements of a request under 56F. You need an affidavit. In that affidavit, it must show what are sought and what they will show. You also have to show in the affidavit how those facts are expected to create a genuine issue of fact. Additionally, you're required to show what efforts you've made, if any, to ascertain those facts and why you weren't able to do so. That's what your holding in Baker Inc. and in Aviation Ventures was. That's what you said. Now, counsel suggests to you that he put in an affidavit that said something like that. What indeed the affidavit said was, we want to have additional discovery regarding the unpaid TIs and defendant's knowledge of same. Not what he did, not what facts specifically he wants to get and why he couldn't get them. He didn't comply with Rule 56F. Indeed, I can understand the reason that counsel would put in that affidavit, because he did no discovery for 6 months. Zippo, none. Not one interrogatory, not one request for admission, nothing for 6 months. And then, faced with a motion for summary judgment, all of a sudden, it becomes critically important for him to do discovery. Judge Bell correctly, under your prior rulings, denied the 56F motion. He didn't comply with the rules, she didn't grant the motion, and she was absolutely correct under your prior holdings. Now, let me turn to another subject that counsel brought up. As you are well aware, estoppel certificates, and I know two of you, prior to taking the bench, dealt in real estate transactions and markets and litigated. Estoppel certificates, as you know, are critically important in commercial land transactions, among other things. What they do is they give the landlord the ability to present to a subsequent purchaser a certificate from the tenant, in this case, that basically says, we have no defenses. And the tenant benefits because, or and the purchaser benefits because they don't have to worry about something coming back later on that's going to affect the income stream that they paid the purchase price for. Now, in this particular case, the facts are undisputed as to what happened. And I think Justice Pickering pointed out a couple of the salient ones. So let me supplement those, if I could, for you just briefly. Remember, this particular lease was executed in February of 2006. The TIs commenced roughly in July of 2006, and by September of 2006, 45% of the TIs had been completed and $203,000, $14,000 short of the TIs granted to the bank in the lease, had already been consumed. By October of 2006, an additional $230,000 in TIs had been accumulated, and 90% of the building was done. Okay? The build-out was done. So at that point, certainly the bank knew of its right to seek reimbursement for the $217,320. They were over it by a lot. Then we get December comes. And in December, it's 100% complete. Now, counsel says that's not true, and in his brief he said it wasn't complete until May of 2007. We know it's true because the vice president of the bank on December 4th, 2006, signed a walkthrough certificate wherein he said that the TIs had been completed on this date, and there was two things mentioned in there that didn't comply. One was need to check the windows. The other was something about trash. But as of that date, December 4th, everything was done.
Does the record show when they took occupation of the premises?
I'm not aware of anything in the record showing the exact date they took occupation of the premises, but certainly as of December of 2004, they knew that $482,000 had been expended in order for them to build out the TIs. They knew as well that they could get $217,320 back from the landlord. And what did they do? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. In April of 2007, they were asked, pursuant to provision 15 of the lease by the landlord, to provide an estoppel certificate. They refused initially to sign the estoppel certificate because there was an outstanding brokerage fee. So we know they had knowledge of what that provision was all about. But yet, even though they knew or should have known that they had a right as of December of 2006 to the $217,000, on May 11th, they signed an estoppel certificate saying, you know, we don't know about anything. We don't know about any defaults under the lease. We don't know about any conditions under the lease that haven't been met. And we don't know about any offsets. That's what they said. My client, relying upon that, went ahead with the sale. And here's the most ironic part of the whole point. They didn't even discover the 217, or at least they claim they didn't, until 13 months later on a routine audit of their leases. So this wasn't some latent thing that was hidden under a bunch of papers. It was discovered by a routine audit of the leases. And now they come before you saying, well, you know, because the estoppel certificate didn't say specifically TI improvements, that you can't enforce it against us. Well, that's not what you said in Yee, right? In Yee, what this court said was it affirmed the application of the estoppel certificate that said had the exact same language as paragraph 7 in this case. It said, I am aware of no any tenant or landlord defaults under the lease. Now, counsel comes back and says, well, you know what? It really wasn't a default. Why? Because we never wrote a demand letter demanding it be cured. That's why it's not a default. Can you imagine what the ramifications of that would be on estoppel certificates in the future? Hypothetically, a landlord or a tenant knows about a laundry list of defaults under the lease, but yet he never writes a letter to the landlord for whatever reason, inadvertence, intentionally, or otherwise. A couple years later, some poor purchaser walks in and says, here, are there any defaults under this lease by either party? Well, no, because we haven't sent the required letter. Is that what you're going to hold? Is that the burden that you're going to put on a subsequent purchaser? Because if it is, think of what that purchaser is going to have to do if they want to buy a piece of property in the state of Nevada. They're going to have to go through every lease, go through every provision of every lease, virtually take a deposition from the seller asking him, well, by the way, is there any default on this provision? Is there any default on this provision? That kind of ruling would forestall real estate sales in this particular community, which, as you all know at this time, is something that we need badly. So, counsel then comes and makes the argument, well, the estoppel certificate is ambiguous. Why? Well, because it doesn't say exactly the same thing as the lease. But it does. Paragraph 15 of the estoppel certificate, or paragraph 15 of the lease, says that a tenant will be required from time to time to give us an estoppel certificate to a subsequent purchaser. So the tenant knows at that point that there is could be a subsequent purchaser. It also says, and he will be asked, or it will be asked, to make a statement that there's no defaults under the lease. So it's identical to the language. It is, truly is. Judge Bell did exactly what she should have done.
Do you agree that, or would you agree with the proposition that if your client had affirmatively known that this was on the books, that this obligation existed for $217,000, it hadn't been claimed, it hadn't been paid, if you could prove that knowledge, would you still say that the estoppel certificate would defeat the claim?
If I understand your question correctly, and I'm not rephrasing it to skirt it, but you're asking me if my client actually knew that indeed there was a, quote, default under the lease that apparently is an active default as opposed to the default that counsel is talking about, would an estoppel certificate that was given at or about the time he had the knowledge, he actually had the knowledge at the time he got this, I don't think he could rely on it. No, I don't.
Okay, so you credit that that could be an issue of fact, because they're treated as contracts, correct?
There is no issue of fact, and let me tell you why. Counsel talks
that was
to you
my
about,
next question.
Counsel talks to you about, well, if they would have looked at the records, okay, they would have found this, or if they would have done a title search, they would have found this. You have the records before you in our appendix. There is nothing in there that would put anyone on notice of this $217,000, except the fact that the landlord was going to allow that as something of a TI. That's a long leap from doing it and owing it to get to that point. So I can't stand before you in good faith and tell you that if my client actually knew of it, that they could rely on it, because that defeats the whole thought of estoppel. I mean, estoppel is we rely upon something, and obviously we can't rely on it if we have that knowledge. But there was nothing before Judge Bell. They brought forward nothing, nor can they, as to my client's knowledge. My client had absolutely no knowledge.
Their argument is that they needed 56F opportunity to conduct discovery on your client's knowledge. Could you address that for me?
My client was here for 6 months. Okay, isn't it funny that all of a sudden it became imperative on the day we filed the summary judgment that they had to take my client's deposition? 6 months, they did nothing. Nothing. You can't reward that. You can't reward that. I mean, two of you used to be on the district court bench. And I'm sure when folks came
Thank you for including me on something.
Had to be on the district court bench. And I'm sure when you got a motion for summary judgment, the first thing you got was an opposition saying, we need more time. My God, we need more time. Everybody needs more time when they're looking at a summary judgment. Of course you do. But at the same time, you have to meet your obligations to get the time. You can't sit by for 6 months and do nothing. You can't come in on the day of the summary judgment hearing and not comply with this two prior Supreme Court rulings requiring you to set forth specifically what facts you're going to get, why you couldn't get them, and how they'll create a material issue of fact.
Okay, Mr. Cannon, let me ask you this. I know you've done a lot of civil litigation in federal court. Do you feel that our jurisprudence under NRCP 56F is consistent with FRCP 56F?
I believe, Justice Gibbons, it is absolutely and directly. In fact, if you look in our brief, we cited a number, probably because I spent so much time over there, we cited a number of federal cases to you. Fed sub cases from Judge Pro, Ninth Circuit cases, Eighth Circuit cases. I believe it parallels directly. Rule 56F is the same in Nevada as it is in the federal court system. And I would submit that the requirements are nothing new. They've been the requirements before this court for many, many years. And you don't have to look far to find them. And they weren't complied with. And Judge Bell did exactly what she was supposed to do. And we'd submit to you that she should be upheld And I certainly thank you for your time and for the probing questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cannon. Mr. Wendt, you have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Wendt, I had a couple questions, and if you could work them into your rebuttal, is why the delay in getting discovery started in the proceedings here, is the delay in noticing the deposition? Secondly, why did it take the bank 13 months after this escrow closed to find this problem?
Okay, in answer to the first question, I'm aware of no rule and no obligation that says a party must complete discovery at one point during the discovery period as opposed to another. Discovery was ongoing. There was still time to conduct, so I don't see any affirmative obligation.
Well, you hadn't done anything other than the 16.1.
We opposed their motion. Their motion came early on, you know, before even halfway through the discovery period, Your Honor. We opposed their motion. We responded to their discovery. Discovery was ongoing. There's no affirmative obligation in the rules that says that, oh, if you're 90 days away from the discovery close, that's the real close of discovery deadline. No, we have up until that date. And I don't recall the second part of the justice question.
The 13-month delay in the bank finding this issue on the reimbursement.
13-month delay, this is an obligation in a lease. There's no expiration date on it. There's a number of different reasons as to why a bank may want to obtain extended improvement allowance at one point in time over another. But that's not what at issue. The delay part is not what's at issue. What's at issue is, what are the recitations of fact in the estoppel certificate? And how do they alter, change, or amend in any way the lease obligations? Judge Bell made a mistake in her order when she ruled on the summary judgment motion without addressing Rule 56F at all. That doesn't show up anywhere in the text of her order. She didn't address it. That's a mistake. She didn't make a finding either way as to whether there are any facts that could defeat their claim. That's just, it's silent. She made a mistake in how she ruled on E. That's not the holding of E. And she also made a mistake in finding that the recitations of fact in the estoppel certificate somehow alter, change, or amend the obligations of the lease. Counsel mentioned in his argument that we have the records of what the new landlord did when it went into this purchase agreement. We have them. There's nothing in there that talks about the tenant improvement allowance. There's the lease. The lease talks about the tenant improvement allowance. Counsel asked, well, what does this do to, what is the ruling on estoppel certificates in the manner we're requesting? What does it do to estoppel certificate jurisprudence on a going forward basis? Yeah, new purchasers, they have to conduct due diligence. Is it too much to ask for a new purchaser to review a lease account history? If they're saying that the lease account history didn't show this unpaid tenant improvement allowance, well, you know what? That's a huge red flag right there. That's something that they would have an obligation to do. Judge Bell's ruling was silent on Rule 56F. There are facts. There's definitely facts that would change the reliance on the estoppel certificate.
Mr. Cannon argued that the affidavit was insufficient as far as complying with the Rule 56F jurisprudence. Tell us why you think it was sufficient.
The affidavit was sufficient, Your Honor, because it's pointing out, and maybe there is magic language to Rule 56F request. I'm not aware of any case that says unless you write it in exactly this manner, you don't get Rule 56F relief. The point's out there. We need to understand what their actual knowledge was, and that should be enough to get us through a 56F motion. There's no harm in the court.
Finish your thought.
Yeah. I have a question.
And we'll have a question for you. Okay. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Rule 56F is out there for situations just like this where there's important operative facts still need to be discovered that would materially change and, in fact, rule against them on the issue in which the summary judgment motion was granted.
Justice Pickering, your question?
I had actually two. One, why doesn't your argument that the estoppel certificate is vague and ambiguous and doesn't apply to your client? I'm puzzled by how Section 9 doesn't apply, okay. That on this date there are no existing defenses or offsets. I had asked you about that.
Yes, Your Honor, first I think we'd have a totally different kind of problem if we were to have operated rent-free of the property. I'm sure we would have gotten a letter and probably lost you from those folks. Nowhere in the lease does it say that we can just deduct out of rent this tenant improvement allowance. Also, and the way that's founded is in the structure of the lease and the commencement date and how commencement date is defined, and that's in the record. You find it on page 144 and also on the first page of the lease. You know, I'd like to direct the court's attention to a later date in the record to read the commencement date, when it's supposed to start, page 144 of the record, 144, 145 of the record, and page 105 of the record. Rent was supposed to commence on that date, and it's not an offset. We don't get to hold it back, and that's what the equitable doctrine of offset's about. Parties that mutually owe each other get to extinguish a debt equitably. That's definitely not what they contemplated here. Definitely not what the bank would have been entitled to do. And I think there was a second part of the question.
Yeah, the second part of the question is with respect to the 56F issue. I see an oblique reference to knowledge, but I don't see any description of who you wanted to depose, what you hoped to elicit, any of the specifics that are customary in the 56F setting. Can you answer what showing there was made to the district court of what precisely you felt you needed in the way of discovery?
Just that, the discovery to the person most knowledgeable, just no individual in particular would have needed requested to the defendant as to what the actual knowledge of was of the defendant at the time it entered the agreement. That's all. That's the operative factor, Your Honor. That's really the whole crux of the issue, what they knew. Judge Bell's ruling doesn't address that. Is it true that there is a fact out there that could change this, the way this court reads the decision? Absolutely. And that's what they knew. So to the extent that you have to specifically identify a person most knowledgeable, and unless you write that magic language, person most knowledgeable, you're somehow denied the opportunity to get the operative fact out there on the record. I don't know that Rule 56F requires that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Wendt, Mr. Cannon, thank you for your excellent arguments and your excellent briefs in this matter.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very interesting issue for us. And this case is stand submitted. We'll be in recess at 11:30.
Thank you, Your Honor.